are you and what are you doing here?
Hi, everybody.
Well, what are we waiting for?
This is fantastic.
Hello, hello, hello.
This will only hurt for 22 minutes.
It's very early. I may have to hurt you. Call me in 5 minutes.
This is something that is treatable. This is something that is fixable.
Hey, this is not a test.
Oh, my God, it's early.
Welcome aboard the Amy Beth Arkwee Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are you? Boy, we're hit with another one, another big loss, Glenn Frey. Just on the heels of losing David Bowie last week, another great, the Eagles co-founder, lead singer, guitarist Glenn Frey, after battling various health complications for the last several months. You know, they postponed the Eagles honors at the Kennedy Center this past fall due to his illness. They thought he'd recover by next year. Oh, what a loss. We will celebrate a bit later his legacy and his music. We'll also take a robust round to the Newsies Sideshow, only 2 weeks or less, really, for the Iowa caucus. And Bernie still has the big mo in Iowa and New Hampshire. Hillary doing better nationally. Will wins in those two states help Bernie? And did anybody change things on the Democratic debate last Sunday? Did anybody watch it? We'll talk. Also, Donald Trump, the man who they say is so authentic, kind of blows his cover at Liberty University yesterday by botching a Bible verse. We'll talk. Will anything matter? We don't know. Hey, speaking of Donald Trump, thank you so much for a great response to our show on Friday when we talked with Libby Handras, the producer of that quashed 25-year-old documentary, Trump, What's the Deal? It's back, and we got some great responses, so thank you. We'll talk about it in the mailbag. We also have our Inspiration to Action shout-outs, some jump starts, and great music to round the whole thing out. We'll get you in the mix. Are you listening live? It is Tuesday, January 19th, a bone-chilling, bitter blast of January after a 65-degree Christmas. I just wanted flurries, not a blizzard. It's coming this weekend, maybe. Number in motion, 347-857-4505. You know we do the 24-7 Twitter tango at AB Rice. For the show only, the Facebook page is open for the more loquacious among us. And I should tell you, the show today brought to you in part by Audiophile, music, books, podcasts, to rest your ears with everything you want to hear from Audiophile. Also by PopNet, arts, culture, and conversation on air, online, 24-7. PopNet now featuring select editions of the Amy Beth Arkwee Show. First, though, let's welcome our guest to the show, and you know it's always a pleasure to welcome fellow authors into the fold. Pam Weber joins us. She has her debut novel out. It's a coming-of-age story called The Wiregrass, set down south in the 60s. Character and place are so important at a place where angels and demons dance. Pam, thank you so much for joining us, and first of all, congratulations. I know getting the first book out is always a real thrill.
Oh, thanks, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you here. So let's talk a little bit about how you came to write this story, and writing in general. I know you have a whole separate career as a nurse practitioner. Was writing something you always wanted to do or something you came to later on as you evolved in your life? Well, give us a little background on your aspirations.
Well, I'm a nurse practitioner, but I'm also an academician. I teach in a school of nursing, and if you know anything about academia, you know it's all about research and publishing and all that kind of stuff. So I've been publishing for about 15 years. I have a four editions of a textbook, theory and reasoning and nursing, and then a bunch of research articles. But I've been doing that for so long, I really wanted to test my wings in another direction. I've wanted to write a novel for a while. I had the story in my head. And finally, about 5 years ago, I finally sat down and put pen to paper and made it happen.
Good for you. Wow, that's great. That's really inspiring for a lot of folks I know. Talk about your influences as a writer, as a reader growing up. I mean, who were you influenced by?
Oh, geez. I love really good literature. And I don't mean that to sound snobby, but I like really good stories that, you know, these great family sagas like what Faulkner did with The Sound and the Fury, what Mitchell did with Gone with the Wind, the stories of Eudora Welty, and in more contemporary, I loved what Catherine Stockett did with The Help, that good southern piece, and for just fun and good stories, Fanny Flagg. One of my favorite books is her Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe. But I really like good literature, and it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, long. It just needs to be well written.
And they're all from the South, it sounds like, all your inspirations. Mm-hmm. So you're really a Southern girl
at
heart. Were you always
in
Virginia?
Yeah. Well, I was born and raised in Virginia, but my mother was born and raised in the Wiregrass, which is South Alabama. So we spent many summers. Yep, that's exactly where it came from, where the title of the book came from. We spent summers down there. I still have family down there. It's a beautiful region.
Yeah, and it's so interesting because in the book, I mean, you really are very evocative of how important the place is. The setting becomes like another character. Talk a little bit about where you lured into the magic of that. Certainly as a child, you would say, as the character in this book, the narrator, mm-hmm. spends her summers down there. So are you that character, or are you just...
No, it's a composite. The book's fiction. It's got a little bit of fact in it, but it's really a little bit of fact wrapped in a tremendous amount of fiction. But I like stories that when I read it, I feel like I'm there.
You can
feel the heat of a hot day or the sting of a thunderstorm, or I just want to feel like I'm there. So when I set out to write The Wiregrass, I thought, okay, time to make it happen. And I actually went back to The Wiregrass three or four different times while I was writing the book to make sure that I was seeing exactly what I wanted to see, hearing what I wanted to hear, feeling what I wanted to feel when I was in these different places, and then trying to capture the language that transmitted that to the reader.
Yeah, I understand that. You want to hear the rhythm and the music in the
mm-hmm.
writing.
Mm-hmm. If you're walking across that hot pavement, just how hot was it? You know, and if it was so hot that you felt like your skin was going to melt off your bones, how hot was that and what did it feel like? I really wanted to get that kind of authenticity in there.
Now, talk about, you said you had this story in your head for a long time, and I understand that because I always have these characters that rumble around in my head for a long time, and finally they speak loud enough they have to burst out and be told,
mm-hmm.
and that's finally what happened to you a few years ago. What came first, though? Was it the setting that you love so much, or was there one character, or the whole story fully formed? How did it emerge for you? I know a lot of folks are interested in the genesis of the creative
mm-hmm.
process.
Well, I think both came at the same time. As having spent so much time in the Wiregrass, I really do love that region. It is it's a rural region. Or at least in the 1960s, there was a real sense of community, that hometown feel where everybody knew everybody. I had family down there. Interestingly, the cousins in the book are based loosely on my own cousins who graciously allowed me to... model characters after their personas as children, or at least what I remembered of their personas as children. So that kind of helped get me started on the characters. I knew the storyline that I wanted to do. I had the beginning, I had the middle, and I had the end, and I just had to literally write to fill in the blanks. And the setting, you can't be in the Wiregrass without that setting becoming very prominent. It's just so different than most places, not only because of the heat, but its geographic setting as well. There's a big aquifer that runs underneath it that influences the region, and it's famous for its incredible storms that it gets coming in off the Gulf of Mexico. So it would be really hard to write a story and not have that setting as a character in the story.
And obviously, it was sort of like in your marrow. This story, you had to see, it was there already. It sounds like
mm-hmm.
before you even sat down to write it.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. The people I kind of knew how I wanted the setting to go, but it had been a while since I had been back. So I literally, in fact, when we used to go down there, I'm really going to date myself here, but we used to go down before the interstate system was there. So we would drive down Old Route 29. All the way to Alabama. So when I first started the book, I literally packed my car and took this long, slow route down Route 29 all the way to Alabama to just begin that transition to go back in time and back into that place. So I knew exactly where in my head and where in this story things were going to happen. It's small rural roads. It's farming communities, tiny small towns, lots of beautiful water because it is sitting on an aquifer, so there's beautiful clear streams and creeks and water lagoons and swimming holes and that kind of stuff, and I just really wanted to see it and experience it again so I could could get it right. In fact, I got a lot of strange looks sometimes because there was one time I literally walked into somebody's yard. They had a huge, beautiful mimosa tree, and I wanted to smell it. So I literally got out of my car and walked under this tree so I could smell what it smelled like and feel what it felt like again. It had been so long. And then I was actually at Ponce de Leon Park. I was using that for one of the scenes at the at a swimming hole, and walked upstream in the stream that was filling this place. And I just walked about half a mile upstream in this beautiful place, and the canopy over the stream was so brilliant. The sun was coming through, reflecting off the water and going back on that canopy. It was beautiful. So I, you know, really had my notepad right with me in the middle of the stream, and I'm writing down the words that struck me as I'm looking at this. And I did that throughout the different places in the Wiregrass. So when I was doing scenes in those particular areas, I could make it as real as possible.
Did you find any, were you disappointed? Anything change in terms of the communities and the small towns since you've been back?
One of the small towns that I wanted to use had actually disappeared. It was small when I was there, and there wasn't a huge industry base in this region. It was a farming community, and the little town literally disappeared. It was boarded up and closed up. So I had to use, which actually, it's sad about the town, but what it forced me to do was to use composites of other smaller towns that were around the area to create this town of Crystal Springs. And I think it was a good composite. But the sad part is, yeah, a lot of these little towns literally have dried up when, you know, the train, there was a train station there at one time. People started driving cars and driving trucks, and the train station just kind of went away. And farming now is not necessarily a real profitable type of business down there. So the little towns that supported that big farming community, many of them have just gone away.
Because I know there's some places that are so remote that things don't, you know, time almost stands still. They still have the Mayberry aspect, but other things, as you said, you know, progress has left these places behind, and people have to move and change their whole way of life, which is a whole other story. But fascinating. Talk to us a little bit about. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and the story takes place in 1968. So in 68, that little farming community was alive and well. And what was really what's close and also placed in the Wiregrass is this place called Fort Rooker, which was then, and this still is, the United States Army Aviation Training Center. And back then, this was before simulation. So, and Vietnam was, you know, in full force. So people, you know, there was, and it was primarily a helicopter war, Vietnam was, and there were training runs going back and forth from Fort Rooker to the different training fields that it had all over the Wiregrass. So not only did you have this small, quiet little rural community, you had the military all over the place. And, you know, we literally could set our watches by the training runs that would go towards. There was a landing field close to this little town, and at 10 o'clock in the morning, this massive blanket of helicopters would fly into Field 10, and then at 10 o'clock at night, they would lift off and fly back to Mother Rooker, which is what they called Fort Rooker.
Well, that's where you have that whole juxtaposition of the old, you know, old world and the world, you know, outside. The dangers of the other world coming
That's
in.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. And now they still have a few helicopters there, but, you know, there's so much simulation that they don't need to put that many birds in the sky anymore.
Yeah, wow. Talk to us about your, this is something which I know our listeners will be interested in, your process in terms of actually sitting down and writing it. You also have, as we said, another career. Did you take time off to write it? Did you just discipline yourself and say, I'm going to write between the hours of X and Z? How did it work for you in terms of your actual writing time?
A little bit of both. I do teach and I do practice one day a week as a nurse practitioner. But the good news is I have summers off. When I teach in an academic setting that goes for 9 months. So I have 3 months in the summer, and I did a lot of writing and then a lot of traveling in the summer. And I literally, one of the things that I needed to do was get back down there. So I literally wrote the first words when I was in the Wiregrass. I stayed at a nice little bed and breakfast down there, and visiting these places, it just started the writing. And then during the school year, I actually have managed to clear a day, and as long as I don't have meetings, and I take that day and I write, and I dedicate it to writing. I turn my phone off, and, you know, of course, my family knows how to get in touch with me, but I really try and isolate myself so I can be productive and turn it around. It still took me about 4 years to write it and get it ready for publication.
So you were very disciplined. It sounds like you really had to buckle down, and you made this commitment to yourself and to get this story told. So, you know, for people who think it just sort of happens, there's a lot of work that goes behind it. You know, we can talk about inspiration.
You know, that's exactly right. I have a friend and a mentor who, when I started this process, and even as I went through the process, said, you've got to do this. If you're not disciplined about it, if you don't shut the world out and just do the writing, even if it's only for a few hours a week, then it won't get done. And, of course, being a nurse and being a teacher, there's some degree of structure that you have to live with professionally anyway. And I just took that same guidance and did it. I just cleared the time, and then I wrote. And one of the most freeing things that I had a mentor say to me one time was, it doesn't matter if it's right yet. Get the words down. Get the words down on paper. There's always going to be time to edit. There's always going to be editors out there that can help you if you're struggling with certain passages. The important thing is to get the creativity and get the words and the thoughts and the pictures and the characters and the setting out of your head and on the paper.
Absolutely. That's perfect advice, I would say. I give that advice all the time to clients
mm-hmm.
and students.
Mm-hmm.
Because perfectionism will do you in. If you're so worried about it being right and being perfect, it's not going to happen because you're going to keep
it's
going back
like
and change.
Mm-hmm. Paralysis yeah. by analysis. Yeah, if you just you've
yeah,
just
exactly.
got to stop
you're
and write put
that
it on
same
the table.
First line
mm-hmm.
over and over again. I mean, just do it mm-hmm. and then worry about it later.
That's exactly right. And there's always editors
I always say,
out there.
Liberate yourself from the concern of the results or how good it is. Just do it. And then we'll worry about how good it is.
Exactly
unfortunately,
right.
there are some people that just do it and then they throw it out into the world and they don't bother. But that's a second issue.
Oh, you know what? That is so true. In fact, when I published The Wiregrass, I was amazed when I found out that 80,000 books a year are published, many of them self-published, and that was one of the biggest criticisms was that they don't go through that editing process. They don't really try to get it in the best shape that you can possibly get it in before you put it out there. And while I'll say I don't think it's perfect, it's pretty daggone good, and I had some great great editors and my publishers, you know, just wonderful. Even though I had published in the traditional setting for 15 years, it was wonderful to work with She Writes Press and Book Warner and Annie Tucker and the rest of them who helped me get this in print.
Yeah, well, you need a good editor no matter how good you are and no matter how
mm-hmm.
how accomplished you are. You could be a bestseller. You could be critically acclaimed. Everybody needs an editor. That's why we sell people. So,
that's exactly right. And you got to have a thick
don't
skin.
Don't be embarrassed.
Because, you know? That's exactly right. You know, if you're going to screw it up and you need those people with fresh eyes to to let
exactly.
you know where you need to polish and fix.
Yeah, so if you're going to self-publish, at least have enough sense to get yourself a good editor. And that's a whole other topic in terms of shopping around.
See,
for that.
See, I couldn't
all,
do
separate,
it. I wouldn't know what I didn't know to self-publish, so I was very grateful to have a good publisher.
Yeah, that's good. And it's something to be proud of after you've gone through all that.
Mm-hmm.
Why go through all the work and then find out that it's, you know, isn't as good as it could be. And, of course,
mm-hmm.
nothing is ever perfect. We all know that, you know. But
well, it's
and
a human condition, isn't it? You
exactly.
know, we can try to make it as perfect as we can, but it's just
exactly.
not going to be there. It doesn't say we don't try, but it's, you know,
right.
seldom is it doesn't make that level of perfection we're hoping for.
Right, and you're always going to get criticism, and there's never you're not going to please everybody, and that's not the point. You just have to do what you you feel good about and put your work into the world when you're
mm-hmm.
ready to do it. Do you feel like you're going to do another one?
Oh, yeah, it's already in the works. I'm doing a sequel to
okay.
The Wiregrass, but we're just getting started, so it's still a couple years away.
What's the reaction been so far? You mentioned earlier in the conversation that your cousins graciously said it's okay if you use us. Have they read it,
mm-hmm.
and are they happy about it? Have you had any
oh, yeah.
contentious comments?
I had them read it before I ever submitted it for publication. And the interesting thing was I actually used different names for them. in the version that they read, and but they didn't want me to do that. They wanted me to use
the
real name. So
oh.
I really did. Mm-hmm. And one of the cousins, John J.D. in the book, had actually died. He died very young at 49. He was our family's version of Huckleberry Finn, extraordinary human being. So part of the wanting to write the book was to get many of the stories that he was involved in on paper. And his widow is still living in Alabama. So we all, literally all the cousins, met at her house and for the day, and had a wonderful reunion, and talked about the book, and you know where we were, and I got their kiss of approval, which was very important to me to get. The reaction to the book has been extraordinary. It's one of these things where I just say, pinch me, this really isn't true. I got the first review I got. I was literally sitting in a restaurant, and this review came in, and I really thought I was going to just get sick. Because I was so nervous. It was a gal named Lee Ambrose, who writes for Story Circle Book Reviews, gave a great review and likened it to Kill a Mockingbird, Tom Sawyer, and Of Mice and Men. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, my God, this is a debut novel, and no, I'm not even close to being in that category. But I think what she did was highlight the fact that, like those authors, like those stories, the Wiregrass is in that tradition of that Southern tradition of writing, where you have angels and demons dancing, and you've got family sagas, and it's the setting is so rich and the characters are deep. I think that's what she was talking about. But that review kind of set it off, and I've gotten some extremely, extremely good reviews, and I'm very grateful, very, very grateful and blessed.
Well, she certainly set the bar high.
Yes, she did.
Some of the subject matter in the book is pretty heavy duty. I mean, when you had to tackle mm-hmm. some of this stuff, mm-hmm. you know, what was your feeling about it while you were writing it and getting it on the page, et cetera, and how much of it was rooted in reality?
Mm-hmm. Well, as a nurse and a nurse practitioner, I deal with abuse, domestic abuse, and unfortunately child abuse much more often than I want to. And I even remember cases when I was a child when there was sexual abuse of children, as tragic as it was. And in 1968, we don't talk about it much now, but in 1968, yeah. It wasn't talked about much at all. And I knew that I wanted to bring that to the forefront. As much as the Wiregrass is special, some of the deep and dark things went on there just as much as they do anywhere else. And I wanted to use the Wiregrass as a vehicle to bring some of this forward, not only to show how insidious it can be, but also how children, adolescents and teens might deal with it, how a community might deal with it, and the good and bad, both for individuals and a community when these types of things happen. So it was important for me to be the vehicle for that. In doing the research on that, one of the things that just struck me, and even to this day, it just blows my mind these are the statistics. But I was on the website for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And one of the statistics that they had there, it was in 2014, they said that over a million children were at risk for or had been sexually abused, been abused, or either were at imminent threat for being abused. A million children. I found that number just flabbergasting. I could not believe it. And it dawned on me that we don't hear about that in the news. We hear about the latest Hollywood scandal. We hear about the latest sports scandal. We know what the Kardashians are doing, but nobody is.
Well, you're not watching enough Nancy Grace.
A million.
You got to watch some more Nancy Grace then, because if you watch Nancy Grace, there's a boogeyman around every corner. So you can find it. This is true.
But it just seems to me that if we really wanted to declare war on something, we ought to declare war on abuse of children, and that's a battle we could win if we gave it attention.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, though. I mean, because people don't want to hear about it. It's like anything else. They want to hear the surface stories. They don't really want to hear
mm-hmm.
the deep and the
They want to hear the good
the
news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the good news or the salacious. You know, it's easier to talk about a celebrity scandal or even, a political scandal, that kind of thing. But getting down to the nitty-gritty subjects are sometimes really dark and horrible. And sometimes fiction, that's where fiction comes in sometimes, too, because it can expose you two things and horrors wrapped up in a story, because everybody loves a good story. So,
That's exactly
as a fiction writer, I know you can wrap things, and instead of just standing on a soapbox and proclaiming it, it can be more effective in fiction. So good for you for making that attempt and taking the time to do it. And I think, you know, you've shed some light for people. We have a lot of writers or aspiring writers listening to the show, and people always want to know, how do you do it? What's the schedule? What's the inspiration? All of that. And sometimes it's just sitting down and doing it. Like you said, you just
That's exactly right.
You have
make
to force yourself to do it,
it,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Make it a priority.
Make it a priority, exactly. Fascinating. Congratulations for making your dream a reality, because you wanted to do this for a long time. It's called The Wiregrass, Where Angels and Demons Dance, Pam Weber. And we can find out more about the book. You can get it, certainly Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the usual suspects. If you have an independent bookstore, I always say support them. You have a website, too, right? Is it pamweber.com?
Uh-huh. It's pamweber.com, or you can also reach it by going to www.thewiregrass.com.
Oh, there you go. You got two. Terrific. Pam, thank you so much for joining us. I wish you the best in the sequel and everything else, and come back and see us again, okay?
Hey, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
You're very welcome. Pam Weber, details at thewiregrass.com or pamweber.com. It is the M. Beth Erkley Show. Reach out via Twitter, AB Writes, phone line 347-857-4505. And here's a little tease.
Every summer was marked by our adventures in wiregrass, in the deepest south. Aunt Pity took in all us cousins, including me, Nettie. During the day, we towed the line, tended the chores, and explored country life. But at night, the wiregrass turned into our playground. We were trouble in Crystal Springs. The neighbors had come to dread us more than Alabama heat. For us, the rural town was a place where mystery and mischief held hands down Main Street. Until the summer I turned 14, it was the only hand-holding I was interested in. That was the summer I met Mitchell. He was the kind of pretty boy that might have invited romantic trouble. That is, if Mitchell's life hadn't already been a whole different kind of trouble. Ain't none of it was his fault. And me and my cousins, we did our best to deliver Mitchell from evil. It will never be over. Not for me. But for Mitchell. That's a story I need to tell.
They had thousand LBJ when the National Guard came in. I thought the world was gonna end. It was crazy in Alabama. My mama yelled, child getting tired. Drew the drapes, locked the doors. We watched the marchers passing by, felt the rumble, heard the roar, and they all held hands, they sang and wept, and freedom rang in every step. Cause a train of change was marching through my hometown. We had the choice to climb on board or get run down. Civil rights, Martin Luther King, KKK, George C. Watson, LBJ, when the National Guard came in. I thought the world was gonna end. It was crazy in Alabama.
Ed Campbell, evoking another part of Alabama's history. Crazy in Alabama. I'm Amy Beth Erkwisch. Also the trailer, the audio version of the trailer. We'll post the video for you. Pam Weber's The Wiregrass. Find out more at her website, thewiregrass.com. On the Twitter feed at AB Wright, Sonia said, love your style. Another good interview. Book sounds intriguing. All right. Thank you, Sonia. And Bindi says, book sounds good. That song was great, too. Yeah, check out Kate Campbell. She's really quite good. Speaking of evoking time and place down south, these great story songs, you got to think about one based in Mississippi. It's Bobby Gentry and her classic Ode to Billy Joe. Give a listen.
It was the 3rd of June, another sleepy, dusty Delta day. I was out chopping cotton and my brother was baling hay. And at dinner time we stopped and walked back to the house to eat. And Mama hollered at the back door, y'all remember to wipe your feet. And then she said, I got some news this morning from Choctaw Ridge. Today, Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. And Papa said to Mama as he passed around the black eyed peas, well, Billy Joe never had a lick of sense. Pass the biscuits, please. There's 5 more acres in the lower 40 I got to plow. And Mama said it was a shame about Billy Joe anyhow. Seems like nothing ever comes to no good up on Choctaw Ridge. Now Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. Brother said he recollected when he and Tom and Billy Joe put a frog down my back at the Carroll County Picture Show. And wasn't I talking to him at the church last Sunday night? I'll have another piece of apple pie. You know it don't seem right. I saw him at the sawmill yesterday on Choctaw Ridge. And now you tell me Billy Joe's jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. Mama said to me, child, what's happened to your appetite? I've been cooking all morning and you haven't touched a single bite. That nice young preacher, Brother Taylor, dropped by today.
dinner on Sunday. Oh, by the way, he said he saw a girl that looked a lot like you up on Choctaw Ridge. And she and Billy Joe was throwing something off the Tallahatchie Bridge. A year has come and gone since we heard the news about Billy Joe. Brother married Becky Thompson, they bought a store in Tupelo. There was a virus going round, Papa caught it and he died last spring. And now Mama doesn't seem to want to do much of anything. And me, I spend a lot of time picking flowers up on Choctaw Ridge and drop them into the muddy water off the Tallahatchie Bridge.
Misty sunrise in my hometown, rows of cotton about knee high. Mrs. Baker down the dirt road, still got clothes out on the line. Irwin Nichols there with Judge Lee, playing checkers at the gym. When I dream about the Southland, this is where it all begins. From Carolina down to Georgia, smell the jasmine and magnolia. Sweet to Sweet Home, Alabama, roll tide roll. Muddy waters, Mississippi, bless the Graceland whispers to me. Carry on, sweet southern comfort, carry on. Catching catfish on the river, chasing fireflies by the creek. Kissing Gary Williams' sister on the porch homecoming week. With rusty cars and weeping willows, keeping watch out in the yard. Just a snapshot of down home Dixie, could be anywhere you are. In Carolina or in Georgia, open arms are waiting for ya. Louisiana, yellow rose of San Antonio. Arkansas, Mississippi, Old Man River whisper to me. Carry on, sweet southern comfort, carry on. As I sit here, I'm surrounded by these priceless memories. I don't have to think about it, there's no place I'd rather be. In Carolina or in Georgia, smell the jasmine and magnolia. Sleepy Sweet Home, Alabama, rough tide roll. Muddy waters, Mississippi, blessed Graceland whispers to me. Carry on, sweet southern comfort. Carry on, sweet southern comfort, carry on.
Show, and you can just conjure the movie in your mind, can't you, with Bobby Gentry's Ode to Billy Joe. Fascinating. Kate Campbell, too, I recommend checking out more of her great music. She's a great alt-country indie artist and crazy in Alabama. And, of course, the audio version of the trailer for The Wiregrass, Pam Weber's coming-of-age novel of the same name. We'll post the video for you on Twitter, as well as the links to her website, thewiregrass.com, and pamweber.com. So find out more about that. Twitter feed at AB Writes, Corey chiming in, another great interview, and I love the tunes. Looking forward to the rest of the show. Thank you, Corey. And Bryn chimes in, so what's the deal with the Trump story? Well, here's the story. We did our interview with Libby Handris last Friday on this documentary. Remember, it was released in 1991, but briefly, because back then they didn't have the internet, so it was squashed pretty much because they couldn't find a distributor for the film. They couldn't find a TV network brave enough to air it because the Trump people were putting pressure on it. It was not a flattering portrayal, to say the least. So it got quashed for all these years. They rolled it out now because now we have the internet and it's up and running. Interestingly enough, after our interview, which, by the way, went viral, our show on PopNet over the weekend, and we had higher than usual live listens and so far archived numbers from BTR, you have to know that we have more listeners on podcasts, much to my chagrin, because you know how I love to play with you guys in real time via Twitter and occasionally on the phone line if you feel like calling in. Like if you're listening live, you can, 347-857-4505. But we've had a lot of listeners, and of course the archive numbers are now growing to the show. So there's a fascination with Trump, pro and con, I guess. But interestingly enough, Libby Handris just told me that shortly after our show, the trailer to the movie was taken down by YouTube due to some kind of bogus tagging issue. So I wonder if there's some gremlins in the muck. But it's back up and running, so we'll post it for you again as well. Interesting, indeed. Thank you for the response, and thank you for listening. We'll continue to give you an opportunity to do so because all the shows are archived for podcasts. That's the beauty of it. You can watch it, or listen to it, rather, anytime you want. BTR site, we're also on Stitcher, Mixcloud, with select editions on PopNet and Arts Radio Network all over the country on both internet and terrestrial stations. So, you know, we get a longevity in terms of listening. That's what I love so much about the on-demand story. So follow us around whenever you want to, wherever you want to, and tune in when you can. So Donald Trump today, big announcement. He just got the endorsement at the John Wayne Museum in Iowa by John Wayne's daughter. Will that be a game changer in any way? The other big, you know, it's spectacle. It's such spectacle, and the man is a master huckster, that's for sure. But yesterday at Liberty University, which is a Christian college founded by Jerry Falwell, now run by Jerry Falwell Jr., he kind of botched, you know, they talk about him being so authentic. He's now claiming to be very Christian and a Bible scholar of sorts, always bragging about how the Bible is the best book, and Art of the Deal is way down. Second, but way down. But he botched a Bible verse, you know, 2 Corinthians as opposed to 2 Corinthians. And they kind of got some boos in the audience. The kids are interesting because they interviewed a sampling of these kids, and it's a Christian college, and they're very evangelical and conservative. And a lot of them are skeptical about Donald Trump, although a couple of people said, well, he's the best bet because I see the train rolling and how it's going. So it's interesting to hear young people talk about their choice for president and how it's all going to play out. Donald Trump waving the Christian banner and saying he's going to make it safe to say Merry Christmas in the mall again, I'm afraid that's like an old 5-10 years ago manufactured Fox News argument that there was a war on Christmas. Not so much. I think you can say Merry Christmas in a mall, even here in the Northeast. It's intriguing for sure how this all rolls. But what about the Democrats? They thought it was a done deal with Hillary. Not so much. Bernie Sanders has the big mo. Imagine this, a 74-year-old Jewish Brooklynite who relocated to Vermont is having as much appeal as Donald Trump, the billionaire turned evangelical, also from New York. So New York is going to play. We'll listen to New York songs in a few minutes, too, because Trump's New York values got into the crosshairs with Ted Cruz's commentary, who may not be eligible because he was born in Canada. I mean, this story just writes itself, and there's a new chapter every day. It's fascinating. For sure. But what about the Democratic debate? They always have it on the weekends. They're like burying those debates. But I saw some of it on Sunday. Hillary, of course, coming out as the pragmatic choice. So she appeals to older voters, while Bernie, who's given away the store, appeals to the progressives and millennials like that because it's free tuition and it's free health care. And, you know, free does have a price tag, though, and that comes in terms of taxation. The whole health care issue is so intriguing to me because Obamacare is a mess. There's no question about that. But is it in the right direction? And if you scrap it all, as the Republicans would like to do, we're going to repeal and replace, but they never tell you what they're going to replace it with. Well, I guess Bernie wants to repeal it too, and he has kind of indicated what he wants to replace it with, but to a lot of people it sounds like pie in the sky. Can he pull it off? I mean, what it took to get Obamacare to the point where it was such a mess, because the insurance companies, I mean, they're not going to go out of business tomorrow. That's the problem. They had such a stronghold. I covered this. I wrote about this for a long time when they were in debates in Congress, and they got through a bill that was way too long. No bill should be 2,000 pages. That's ridiculous. And all the provisions and all the problems. And the premiums are going up. You know, as somebody who, you know, is self-employed, I can tell you that. But is it better to have some people insured, more people insured? Is it better to not have the pre-existing conditions, to have kids be able to stay on their parents' insurance longer, all of those things? How easy would it be to scrap it and start over again? Whether you're talking about the Republican plan, which is dubious, or Bernie's plan, which is strictly abolishing the insurance companies, essentially, and having Medicare for all. It sounds good. I'm not sure if it's going to work, and not sure if it would ever be implemented, or passed, I should say, before we get to the implementation stage. What's your take? Let's hear about it. A.B. writes on the Twitter feed, phone line 347-857-4505. But they didn't think they were going to be in this position, the Clinton campaign. It's like deja vu all over again from 8 years ago. Too close for comfort. Does Chelsea's mom really still have it going on? Think about it. Let me know.
But I think the American people
are sick and tired of hearing about
your damn emails.
In my view, Secretary Clinton, Congress does not regulate Wall Street. Wall Street regulates Congress. And we have got to break off these banks
into little pieces. and then flush the pieces down the toilet so you can never put the banks back together.
The only way we really transform America and do the things that the middle class and working class desperately need is through a political revolution.
I don't have a super PAC. I don't even have a backpack. I carry my stuff around loose in my arms like a professor.
Our government is going to work for all of us, not just a handful of billionaires.
I own one pair of underwear. That's it. Some of these billionaires, they got 3-4 pairs.
We need the American people to know what's going on in Washington in a way that today they do not know.
BernieSanders.com. Check it out. It's a mess.
Round up the usual suspects.
Competitors since the last debate, with only 7 joining us tonight. So remember, candidates, if at any time tonight your poll numbers drop below 3%, you will hear a loud gong, then be escorted off the stage like Showtime at the Apollo. At which point, you'll take a seat in the audience next to that sweet rose of the Carolina, Senator Lindsey Graham. The next question is for our front runner, Donald Trump.
Thank you, Maria Tony Romo.
Okay. Mr. Trump, since the last debate, Ted Cruz has pulled ahead of you in Iowa. Is it true you've started attacking him because you see him as a threat?
Frankly, Maria, I'm glad everyone is talking about my good friend Rafael Eduardo Cruz. People are coming up to me all the time saying, Donald, Ted Cruz was born in Canada. He can't be president. His campaign is illegal. Their words, not mine.
Donald, this debate about natural-born citizenship is just political nonsense. Clearly, I am not Canadian. Canadians are well-liked. I am not. Canadians are rugged and outdoorsy, where I myself am mostly made of pudding. Canadians are genuine and warm, whereas when I smile, it looks like I'm peeing.
All right, Governor Christie, if I ask you a question, do you promise not to turn your answer into a tirade against President Obama?
I promise.
How would you change the tax code?
Barack Obama is the worst president in history. And when Chris Christie is president, the first thing we will do is kick your rear end out of the White House, buddy.
Well, whoever is elected President Obama will be required to leave. It will be the end of his term.
Yeah, because I'm going to send him packing, so...
He'll already have packed and left because his term will be over.
Yeah, well...
This next question is for Jeb.
It is?
Wait, I'm sorry. No, I'm wrong. It says Ted Cruz. Mr. Cruz, you suggested Mr. Trump embodies New York values. Could you explain what you mean by that?
I think most people know exactly what New York values are. And frankly, they are not the rest of the country's values. Instead of celebrating Christmas, New Yorkers celebrate a pagan holiday called Festivus. Instead of watching American football, they challenge each other to masturbation contests. In New York, people don't say hi to their neighbors. They say, hello, Newman.
Sounds like you're describing the TV show Seinfeld. Is that what you mean by New York values?
Believe me, if I could say liberal Jews, I would.
Dr. Carson, you've said we're not doing enough to dismantle and destroy ISIS. What would you do as president?
Well, whenever I think of ISIS, I get so furious. I just go into beast mode. Okay, look. Okay, war has changed in the 6,000 years that the Earth has existed. Our enemies can now send an electromagnetic pulse into our exo-atmosphere, scrambling our electricity. I'm talking dirty bombs, cyber fights, laser people, and Robotron.
Mr. Trump, we now turn to China.
Hold on. I'm getting a call from a respected expert. Hello? What? You're saying Jeb Bush is a little girl?
No, I'm not.
And he can't be president because his hand's bigger than his face?
Oh, that's not true. Look. Oh, dang it!
Oh. Our next question is for Marco Rubio.
Can I ask my question myself? Why am I not winning? Is it the boots? I could lose the boots. I mean, come on. I'm young, I'm smart, I'm the only one up here with a chin. There's 6 clowns up here and 1 human man. Why is no one paying attention to me?
What did you say?
Oh, I wasn't listening. Finally, we turn to Governor Bush. Governor, would you like to tell everyone the joke I heard you practicing in the bathroom earlier?
Okay. In Hillary's first 100 days as president, she's gone from the White House to the courthouse.
It's okay. You don't need to tell jokes because you are one, Jebra.
That's not my name.
Yes, it is. And I have it on good authority that Jebra is wearing Spanx right now.
You shut up. They're for support.
All right. Well, we'll take our first break now. Oh, this is exciting. We have confirmation that Chris Christie has just dipped below 3% in the national polls.
way. Come on.
Never mind about my feelings. Never mind about my suffering. It's just about your show. Not even our show. Your show.
You got that right. Hey, welcome aboard the Andy the Third. We show some spot-on stuff from Saturday Night Live. Boy, they can do that political humor so well. Last week's opener on the last GOP debate. Hilarious. Also, a mashup between Bernie Sanders and Larry David on SNL. And Bernie's impressions of the world. Gotta love it. Also, Will Strong, the parody of Stacey's mom, turned it into Chelsea's mom. She's got it going on, or does she? Beatles 2 and Revolution. If you're talking about a revolution, somebody's got to pay for it and agree to it. All of those things when you talk about Bernie Sanders and his Big Mo, especially with millennials. He's got the millennial vote, again, I think, primarily because they want bold changes, and they want some free stuff, frankly. They want free tuition, and they want free health care, and we all do. But can it get done? That becomes the question. Reach out via Twitter, AB Wright, some intriguing folks chiming in. Melody says, Bernie Sanders is the only candidate in either party with a net positive favorability rating. Intriguing. It's true, because if you think about Hillary and Trump, their unfavorables in polling way outweigh their favorables. So if they run together, it'll be interesting. But can Bernie pull it off? You have a lot of conservatives like Ben Ferguson, the conservative commentator and radio show host, who says, I want Bernie to win so bad, to beat Hillary so bad, rather, that it's almost unhealthy. Think about it, because I know Bernie right now is leading against Trump in the polls, but the polls, as Bernie himself would say, is only a quick reflection of what's happening today and exactly how they do the polls and all of that. Also, who are they polling? It's true, though, in the most recent poll, Bernie does best Trump by 15 points, Hillary only bests him by 10. And Trump, in Trump speak, it means he's beating everybody. He's mopping the floor with everybody because he pretends the polls are – he's very emperor's new clothes, and he's a master at it. And that's what we talked about with that documentary, Trump, What's the Deal? Reach out with your views. AB Wright's on the Twitter feed, 347-857-4505 on the phone line. And I think the Facebook page, Aurora tells us, is open as well if you have a more loquacious bent today and you have things to say. I want to give our quick Inspiration Action shout-out today to Frankie, who is in Toledo, Ohio, and says that there's a novel brewing, and I'm working on it. And I wouldn't have started it without starting the challenge, which helped me focus and, frankly, reignite my passion and desires. Well, there you go. See, thank you, Frankie. Good luck to you. I hope it works out. Keep going. And you have to have, as we talked about in our earlier discussion with Pam Weber, that discipline. You have to just sit down and face the page. And sometimes the muse is with you, and sometimes she ain't, if you know what I mean. But if you work it, the muse will come and help you and inspire you as you go. So there's a lot of hard work involved, as well as all the airy-fairy magical stuff, too. That's your reward, the airy-fairy magical stuff. But sitting down and doing the hard work is important. But the idea of the challenge, as I always say, is to reignite that passion and that creativity and, you know, access that creative well that I know is within you. If you want to do it, it's got to be there. I mean, not everybody wants to do it, but if you do want to do it, it's got to be in there and you can access it if you want it and you work at it. So really, it's to open you up to your dormant creativity, to open you up to a better place in the world, to see yourself as an artist walking in the world, all of that. And it's very simple. Just get that journal out and start writing about those things that bring you joy, inspiration, and gratitude every single day. And then we talk about action plans and goal setting. And if it's working for you, I'd love to give you a shout-out. Reach me at the website, amybetharkawy, ARKAWY.com. Easy access via the Twitter feed. And also, if you need some cajoling, you're kind of in a creative ditch, I can help push you out of it with a creativity coaching counseling conversation. First one is always on me. No panacea promise, but we can work together and strategize on ways to reignite that passion and that creativity. Again, it's amybetharkawy, ARKAWY.com. We'll start a conversation as soon as we can. How about that? Hey, and while you're at the website, by the way, you can peruse my stories. The Eliza Gordon Mysteries are available for ebook and paperback, Killing Time, Dead Silent, the Mystery and Mayhem award-winning second book, and the third one coming this spring. So I know folks want to know what happens. And a lot happens, and the third one will be available sometime this spring. So a lot of things are happening, of course, in the campaign trail. And in the news, Ted Cruz started this whole thing because, of course, he's got that birther cloud hanging over his head. Thank you very much, Donald Trump, or thank you, Mom, because he was born in Canada. And there was some rumbling this weekend that maybe his mom was really a Canadian citizen because she had registered to vote. I don't know if you heard that. I'm not sure if that's confirmed. But they better resolve it. I'm kind of with Donald Trump in this fact that it should be resolved. The fact that he is relishing Ted Cruz's little problem is another story. But the Democrats are waiting to pounce. Alan Grayson, the Democratic rep from Miami who's now running for Senate, indicated that he's going to file the lawsuit as soon as Ted Cruz gets the nomination. He says he's not going to do it until then because it's useless if he's not really in contention, which I don't quite get either. So, but maybe Ted Cruz can fix it all up. Anyway, in the interim now, the bromance is over, and Ted Cruz and Donald Trump are going head-to-head, and they had that little kerfuffle about what Cruz called Trump's New York values, which Trump, they replayed over the weekend ad nauseum, his appearance, and I think it was 1999 on Meet the Press, in which he says, well, yeah, I'm a liberal because I grew up in New York, so I believe in gun control and I believe in the right to choose and all of that. He, of course, has taken back all of those things now that he's a staunch conservative, but that's a whole other thing. So New York was up in arms. Daily News had that very provocative drop-dead Ted Statue of Liberty giving him the finger cover. And he has since sort of apologized, not really, right? Didn't he say he's sorry to the New York people for having to survive people like de Blasio and Cuomo and all our liberal values? Clearly, Ted Cruz wanting to point out to the whole country that New York is not his home.
Thoughts were cloudy, and I had begun to doubt all the things that were me. Been in so many places, you know I've run so many races. Looked into the empty faces of the people of the night. Something is just not right, 'cause I know that I gotta get out of here. I'm so alone. Don't you know that I gotta get out of here? 'Cause New York's not my home. Though all the streets are crowded, there's something strange about it. I lived there about a year and I never once felt at home. Big time, I learned a lot of lessons awful quick, and now I'm telling you that they were not the nice kind. It's been so long since I have felt fine. That's the reason that I gotta get out of here. I'm so alone. Don't you know that I gotta get out of here? 'Cause New York's not my home.
Grow in New York City. crash time dream come true. Just stand at the edge while people run you through. And I thank the Lord there's people out there like you. I thank the Lord there's people out there like you. While Mona Lisa and the Mad Hatter, sons of bankers, sons of lawyers, turn around and say good morning to the night. For unless they see the sky, but they can't, and that is why. They know not if it's dark outside or light. It's fraught with God. It's got a lot of songs to sing. If I knew the tunes, I might. Go my way alone, grow my own seed, shout this song in New York City. Subway, no way for a good man to go down. Rich man can ride, and the hobo, he can drown.
Your business trip extended through the weekend. suburban boy here for your first time. From the 27th floor above the Midtown door, you were startled by her beauty and her crime. And she's every girl you've seen in every movie, every dame you've ever known on late night TV. And her scene and feel is the passion you look down and see her ruined places. Smoke and ash still rising to the sky. She's happy that you're here, but when you disappear, she won't know that you're gone to say goodbye.
Future, babe, they can let is sad. New love brings back all the old love that you've ever had. I put out a casting call and you cast a spell.
About New York on the Emmy Bethurkui Show. Dan Byrne, a love letter to the late lamented Chelsea Hotel. Yeah, I know it still stands, but that, you know, gritty bastion of artistic decrepitude is long gone. It's now a high-rent boutique hotel with very few original tenants allowed to remain, I think. They're all pushing them out as fast as they can. Chelsea Hotel. And Suzanne Vega, New York is a woman. Early Elton John, singing about those Mona Lisas and Mad Hatters, the subway system, Spanish Harlem. You can evoke those great pictures, right, from those words. And Jim Croce, New York's Not My Home, for Ted Cruz. Indeed, it's not. New York values a dog whistle to the more conservative of the Republican base. Donald Trump, in fact, had his finest hour, I think, when he came to the defense of New York as a native New Yorker, singing the praises and the pride that we all shared in the wake of 9/11 and how New Yorkers stood up for each other and the world. I don't think a few years ago you could have pulled that off, taking a potshot at New York, but times have changed and things continue to roll on. Indeed. See, when you're authentic, Donald Trump, you're really authentic, but sometimes you're a poser, like you were at Liberty University, waving the Bible. Laughable, really. Strange days indeed. Unfortunately, as things roll on, we say goodbye to people, and last week it was shocking to say goodbye to David Bowie. Equally shocking last night to learn of the passing of Glenn Frey, the founding member of the Eagles, who we knew was struggling with health issues. In fact, they had postponed his Kennedy Center honors for the Eagles until next year because there was all hope that he would have a full recovery. Not to be. He passed away yesterday in New York at the age of 67, left behind a great legacy. In fact, the Eagles, big band. I mean, there's some contention of whether or not they were the number one selling album of the 20th century or the second to Michael Jackson's Thriller. In any event, the Eagles' greatest hits, 71 to 75, sold an astounding 26 million copies in the U.S. alone, over 40 million sold worldwide. An amazing amount of work over the years. Of course, they have their contentious, famous breakup, their fights on stage and off stage throughout the years, but they got back together and are still together now in some configuration. Glenn Frey and Don Henley, of course, the founding members, remained. They lost Bernie Leadon, Randy Meisner, Don Felder, who apparently walked off during an actual show, a fight with Glenn Frey. Glenn was known as a perfectionist. He demanded great work from everybody. He was someone who believed in elbow grease, and that elbow grease got him very far into the hearts and minds and souls of so many fans. Glenn Frey, rest well, and wow, hard stuff. Don Henley said, you know, he doesn't believe in fate, but his life certainly changed in 1970 when I met Glenn Lewis Fry. My life was changed forever. I can't imagine walking in the world without him. He had an interesting anecdote when they lived together in Laurel Canyon in the early days. It was like an odd couple scenario. He was Felix. Glenn was Oscar. He said, I was doing all the housework and cleaning up after Glenn, who obsessively would leave cigarette butts around the place, popping up like little cities. Mm-hmm. So you can have a visual of what those guys were like in those early days. Glenn Fry, rest in peace. Hey, thanks so much for joining us. A busy show indeed. Thank you, Pam Weber. The book is The Wiregrass. We'll post all the links and everything on Twitter. Thank you to Trudy and Aurora working hard in the booth, ML at TCS headquarters. Thank you for joining us. Don't forget to catch us on Twitter at AB Writes. You can follow our producer, Trudy Hart, at Radio Trudy, friend me on Facebook, and all roads lead back to the website, amybetharkawi.com. Drive safe, play nice, dream big, and please don't let the sound of your own wheels make you crazy. We'll leave you with a couple from the Eagles. I'm Amy Beth Arquisha. Take care.
time wishes went by so fast, just like a dream. We knew it couldn't last. I must be leaving soon. It's your world now. It's your world now. My race is run. I'm moving on. Like the setting sun. No sad goodbye.
Something good behind the curtain falls.